Avi and I spoke about his trip to America, and he told me he was going to be in Florida. I said, well, maybe you can talk about that here, give us a perspective from somebody who lives in the country, and who has a no pun intended, a pulse on what's going on in Israel, and hopefully you can enlighten us. And so what we're hearing tonight is a perspective. It's not the only perspective. And I'm sure that after all this, we may have questions, and those questions are always welcome, and we will do our best to keep this conversation forward-focused and hopefully educational for us all. So thank you so much, and thank you, Avi Eglon.
So thank you so much, Rabbi Billitz. I was asked to speak about the situation with the Supreme Court. This is a loaded issue, okay? But it doesn't have to be that loaded. And the first thing I'm going to ask from each and every one of you is to go into this evening just with a clean slate as much as possible, with an open mind, because I hope some of the things I'm going to give over to you, some of the facts I'm going to give over to you, are going to be a little mind-blowing, because it's factual information that is not being given over to us. And as someone who now works in the internet world of marketing, so to speak, or content, context is king. Okay, context. And unfortunately, especially in the lightning speed reporting, I mean, I grew up also when you used to read the news on Shabbat, and it took days to put together to research articles. Now articles go up in seconds. So even if some of the information is factual, it's just not always as the proper context given in order to truly understand issues. And the more serious the issues are, and the more implications they have on our lives, well, the missing of that context is extremely serious. So I hope some of the information I give tonight, and deep going more of a deep dive and giving background, we'll have a better understanding for the context, so then each and every one of you to make your own decisions based on what you hear and don't hear in the daily media reporting. So I want to start by possibly shocking some of you, if not all of you. Anyone familiar with the Israeli politician who's no longer actively in politics, but he's a very well-known name in Israel, Chaim Ramon? Who was Chaim Ramon? Okay, wait, before, hold on. You're getting ahead of myself. You're doing great, but you're getting ahead of yourself. What party was Chaim Ramon in?
Labor.
Chaim Ramon is a Labor Party. He was very influential, very powerful in the Labor Party. He was a minister of a number of different ministries. And I don't remember the exact year, but he was the Minister of Justice. Okay, and he ran the Istadrut. Okay, he was the Minister of Justice. Now, just this past Shabbat in Israel, he was interviewed, full article. Anyone here who knows how to read Hebrew, I don't think it's been translated into English, very important to read what a labor leader, he was one of the top leaders, he was looked at as the future of the Labor Party, we're talking the center left. All right, and then was a justice minister. Very important to read what he has to say. Full interview of him. It's not just quotes, full interview. And this is one of the quotes from the article. I'm going to say it in Hebrew and translate it into English. Ani omer lechavarai basmol. All right, I am telling my friends on the left. Ibadetem et ha'imun biyicholtchem la'alot l'shilton. Atem lo demokratim. You have lost the ability to be elected. You are not being democratic. Atem lo ma'aminim b'demokratia. You no longer believe in democracy. Lachen atem rotzim limshol be'emtzaut beit hamishpat. And it's because you know you're not electable anymore that you want to rule by having control over the Supreme Court. This is not Bezalel Smotrich. This is not Itamar Ben-Gvir. This is not Bibi Netanyahu. This is Chaim Ramon, former leader of the Labour Party, who was a justice minister. And as you, now you could say, what were you about to say? What is your name?
Len.
Len, what were you about to say that I stopped you?
He's pointing out that the justice ministers appoint themselves as opposed to being elected. And so they can control who's going to be on the Supreme Court and who's not going to be.
Yeah, so you're referring to the Supreme Court judges? Okay. So one thing, before getting to that, another very important thing to remember, Chaim Ramon, he pushed forward judicial reform when he was justice minister. All right? Because back then, this is back in the, like, I don't remember the exact year, I'm not even going to guess. But when he was justice minister, he already then knew that there were problems within the Supreme Court. He had plans and proposals to change and reform the Supreme Court. Guess what happened to him? He was taken down by a case. He was removed as justice minister because he inappropriately kissed a subordinate, supposedly. And the judicial reform was stopped in its tracks. All right? So that is very, very important history of Chaim Ramon. Reforms that were being done by a labor justice minister, that was stopped in his tracks. And he is not the only justice minister who was stopped from making judicial reforms. Another potential justice minister, brilliant legal mind, respected across the political platform in Israel, across the political spectrum, Yuval Ne'eman. They didn't even let him become justice minister. Some cases were cooked against him. I'm saying cooked. You could do your own research. And made a whole scandal. And because of that, he was not allowed to be appointed justice minister. And then you have another justice minister that also comes from the center left, Daniel Friedman, well-respected legal mind in Israel. He had justice reform plans as well, and he was stopped as well from imposing judicial reform. So there are a couple of things to take from this. First of all, it's not the issue and importance of judicial reform is not just a right-wing issue. There are other Israelis from the center left who know how important it is. Know that there are problems, very, very problematic problems that have to be changed. So that's one thing to take away. Two, historically, every single time there was a justice minister that wanted to implement justice reform, somehow they all had cases that came up that made them stop from being able either to serve as justice minister or to bury the judicial reform. Let's start with that. Now I want to take a step back. I'm taking a step back to then jump forward. All right? And I want to inspire you for a second. All right? I'm taking a step back from the judicial issue and inspire you. First of all, number one inspiration. We are the most blessed generation of Jews probably since King David's time. That we are living in a time where we are sovereign in our ancestral homeland, we have our own army to be able to defend ourselves, and we are flourishing with all of the challenges, with all of the hardships, with all of the terror. This has been the quietest and safest period to live as a Jew thousands of years. Even with all of the problems, even with all the terror. And as it is always important for me to give over whenever I speak about any issue, and no matter how tough or how controversial, to ensure that people do not throw the baby out with the bathwater. There is so much good taking place with the Jewish people being back as sovereign in our ancestral homeland. The state of Israel is doing so much for humanity on so many levels. It is mind-boggling, mind-boggling. And in addition to that, even with all of our divisions, and we have divisions, We've always had divisions. We've always had arguments. We're Jews, right? Every Jew, three opinions, right? I honestly can say, and anyone here who knows history, please argue with me. The level of unity within the Jewish people in the land of Israel today is, again, a high level. Even though the headlines tell us otherwise, even though on the ground sometimes there are very divisive issues, but on the ground, I live there. You all have family members there who live there, you have friends who live there, you visit there, on the ground. There are more Haredim in the workforce today. There are more Haredim in the army today. Secular and religious and Haredi are all over the place throughout Israeli society. Yes, if you listen to the headlines, it's scary and it sounds really, really bad. That's why I like to tell people, stop reading the news. Because sometimes it's a self-fulfilling prophecy because of what the media agenda is. And the sensationalism, or to get the clicks or the money, who knows what. But it does not reflect reality on the ground. So no matter how divisive this Supreme Court issue might be, whether here in Boynton, I don't know, maybe it is or isn't, between friends, neighbors, friends, no clue, or in Israel, it is so important for me to get that message across. Do not throw the baby out with the bathwater. Israel is amazing. We've gone through much more horrible things. And we're going to get through this one together too. And most of the Jewish people in the state of Israel are united. It's a tiny, tiny minority who are out in the streets creating chaos. Even though, again, the media is creating it as if the whole country or half the country is up in arms. It's not the story at all. Okay. Now I want to tell you two stories to then jump back into the judicial issue. And these are two stories that I know personally. Story number one, there's a very special program in Israel called Nativ in the Israeli army. Anyone familiar with it? What's the Nativ program? The Nativ program is the conversion program in the IDF, mostly for Ukrainians, Russians who live in Israel, are not halachically Jewish. They did not converts while they were living in Israel, no matter how many years they were living in Israel. And then when they're in the army, there is this program where they have the opportunity to convert by the army, okay? And one of the parts of the program, of this Nativ program, of this conversion program, is they go spend a Shabbat at Shomer Shabbat family during the course. So our family, when every once in a while, they send the program to Efrat, where I live, with my wife and kids, and we host these soldiers, sometimes guys, sometimes girls. And usually, again, they're Russians and Ukrainians. So we had one Shabbat a number of years ago, we had like four soldiers staying by us for Shabbat, going around the table. All right, this is a Russian name, Ukrainian name, Russian name, Ukrainian name, whatever, there were four or five of them. And then one guy says, what's his name? Muhammad. I'm like, well, Muhammad in a... They're soldiers. They're IDF soldiers. Muhammad is an IDF soldier in a program to convert to Judaism. I'm like, okay, Muhammad, where are you from? Gaza. I'm like, whoa, the story's getting deeper. Okay, will you please tell us your story? A Muslim from Gaza serving in the IDF converting to Judaism. What's his story? And I'll tell it pretty quickly. His father worked for the Palestinian Authority in Gaza, in the Gaza Strip, post-2005. 2007, Hamas had a military coup against the Palestinian Authority, right? These Arab Muslims were killing Arab Muslims, even though they're supposed to be one people who we're supposed to make peace with, okay? But that's another talk for another time. The Hamas were killing the officials from the Palestinian Authority, literally throwing them off rooftops and murdering them in the streets. So Muhammad's father's life was in danger. His father understood that Hamas was bad news for the Arab Muslim population in the Gaza Strip, so he secretly began helping the IDF in terms of targets or whatever with information about Hamas. So his life was even in more danger. As a thank you for the assistance that Muhammad's father gave to the state of Israel. The state of Israel secretly, smuggled Muhammad's family, his father, his mother, him, and I think he had three brothers, there are four brothers, into Israel and gave them Israeli citizenship. Did you ever hear a story like this in the news? Does it fit the narrative of what the news tries to tell us every day about the good guys and the bad guys? And but that's not it. Excuse me? It's one case, but ready, but let's continue. So I asked Muhammad, that's wonderful. Why are you serving in the IDF? Well, he said, well, I was educated all my life, me and my brothers, that the Jews are evil and they're trying to kill us. And here I experienced that the Jews saved the life of me and my family, because it was my brothers and cousins and neighbors who were trying to kill us. As an appreciation to the Jewish state of Israel, he was the youngest of four brothers, all my brothers and myself wanted to serve in the Jewish army of the state of Israel. So I said, okay, that's amazing. Why convert to Judaism? And again, he said, I was, because of this experience and appreciation for the Jewish state of Israel, I realized that I was basically raised on lies. And the Jewish people and Judaism is not what we're taught. And on the other hand, my life of Islam was not what I was taught either. And he's the youngest of four brothers. All three of his brothers and him all converted to Judaism and all served in the Israeli army. Right? And I actually, he called me the day that he went to the Beit Din and was converted, and he was as happy as anything. And a little anecdote, at the table, again, there were like three or four Russian Ukrainians, and then Muhammad. Guess who asked the most questions? He was the only one at the table who was seriously interested in learning about Judaism and what we were doing on Shabbat, and he ended up converting. Now, regardless if this is one story or not, what this one story tells us is that nobody, and no media source is telling anyone the truth about what's going on in the Middle East. Not about Gaza, not about Hamas, not about the Palestinian Authority, not about who's the good guy and who's the bad guy, nothing. Everything is basically fake news, what you read every day about Israel. Everything. Might be some facts that are true, but the overall perspective of how things are being written and portrayed, it's all fake news. Story number one. Story number two. Anyone who watches my program, I have a daily video. It's called The Pulse of Israel. It's a video and a podcast. Anyone who's not yet watching, you're more than invited to sign up and begin getting my daily newsletters with the videos talking about Israel, the Jewish people, the freedom-loving world, and current events. And sometimes I do monologues about current events issues, and sometimes I interview people. Interesting people, important people, not important people doing amazing things, and therefore they're important. So I had the opportunity to interview a terrorist. Obviously, he's a reformed terrorist. Otherwise, why would I be interviewing a terrorist, right? Okay, what's this reformed terrorist story? And again, anyone who's interested, I could send you this video. You can watch it yourself. Don't trust anything I say tonight. Don't trust me. Don't trust me. I'm also media. Don't trust me. Do your own due diligence. Right? That's all I want. I just want to allow people to have information that is not told at all. And then you make your own decisions. All right? So go watch this video. Don't trust me. What's his story? He was raised in Jenin to be a terrorist by the Palestinian Authority, by Fatah. And he went out to murder Israelis together with his partners. Thank God the IDF stopped them and arrested them before they were able to kill anyone. So he ended up sitting in Israeli jail. All right, fast forward. He spent time in jail. He ended up doing a deep dive of Islam and on his own realizing that he's been brainwashed about killing Jews, etc., etc. He decided when he got out of jail, he didn't want to be a terrorist anymore. Instead, he wanted to have a kosher lifestyle, so he started smuggling into Israel and working illegally, and then helping other Arab workers smuggle into Israel to work illegally, etc., etc. Okay? One day, he was helping a group of Arab Muslims from the Shomron smuggle into Israel to work, and one of the Arab workers that he was smuggling was a suicide bomber. Okay? And he, a suicide bomber. And he, this guy, alerted the IDF and saved the lives of the IDF soldiers from this suicide bomber. And once again, as an act of appreciation, the State of Israel smuggled him and his family, his wife and kids, into Israel and gave them Israeli citizenship as a thank you for saving Israeli lives and stopping that terrorist attack. This reformed terrorist now goes around Israeli schools and tries his best to meet with diplomats, Israeli politicians and foreign diplomats, and he has one message to them. And again, don't trust me. Anyone interested, put your name down on the sheet at the end. I will send you the video and you could watch it, the whole interview yourself. And his one message is very simple. The Palestinian Authority is a corrupt, terrorizing entity that oppresses my people, meaning him, meaning the Arab Muslims. And when the governments of the world, the United States, European governments, the United Nations, the European Union, when they give money to the Palestinian Authority, they are enabling the continued oppression of his people by the Palestinian Authority, and he tells every diplomat he can, stop giving money to the Palestinian Authority. Nothing about Israel. Nothing about Israel. It's about what the Palestinian Authority is doing to their own people. All right? Now, how is this all connected to the judicial reform? How did we get here? How did we get here? Now, I'm talking to an audience who has a memory of the beginning of the 1990s. Sometimes I don't. You guys do. Do you all remember when Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin expelled 400 terrorists to Lebanon? Right? 400 terrorists to Lebanon. They were all up there in Lebanon for, I imagine, like a half a year or so. I don't remember exactly, so you can go check. Then what happened?
They bring them back.
Who made the Israeli government and Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin bring back 400 of the worst terrorists that were in Judea and Samaria and Gaza at the time?
Blair.
Huh? Supreme Court. All right? As a result of that, in addition to many other instances where Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, I'm not talking about Smotrich, I'm not talking about Ben-Gvir, I'm not talking about Netanyahu, I'm talking about Yitzhak Rabin, the leader of the center-left when he was prime minister. His quotes for why he agreed to do the Oslo Accords, does anyone remember his famous quote? Blee?
We make friends with our enemies.
No, something else. Blee Bagatz. Ubli Bitzelem. Yitzhak Rabin said, why am I doing these Oslo Accords? I can't fight and stop the terrorism against Israeli citizens. The ones who will be able to do it without being stopped by the Supreme Court and without being stopped by the very anti-Israel organization, Israeli organization called Bitzelem, that with European funding is the one that always petitions the Supreme Court, that then the Supreme Court ends up stopping the Israeli army and government from doing what is necessary in order to protect Israeli citizens. Yitzhak Rabin basically put his hands up. He said, I can't do it anymore because the Supreme Court doesn't let me defend Israeli citizens. I'm going to do the Oslo Accords because Arafat, a terrorist who I'm trusting, and this new Palestinian Authority, will be able to kill the Hamas terrorists without being at the interference of the Supreme Court and B'Tselem. And again, that was said not by Smotrich, not by Ben-Gvir, not by Netanyahu. That was said by Yitzhak Rabin. And that's, in a sense, what changed. And my family, what changed? My family made Aliyah in 1990. We used to drive right to Efrat. And I remember, I'm sure many of you might have remembered this as well, if you ever drove out to Efrat in those days, or to Hebron. What city did we used to drive through in order to get to Gush Etzion and to Hebron? Back in Beit Lechem. We used to drive through Beit Lechem. Okay? So let's just put things into perspective. Before the Oslo Accords, Jews were able to drive peacefully through Beit Lechem, and the worst of the terror that we used to experience was rock throwing. And the Supreme Court was not allowing the Israeli army to stop the rock throwing. Okay? After the Oslo Accords, you think any Jew can drive peacefully through Bethlehem, through Beit Lechem today? No, your life's in danger. Now they have guns. Now they have years and decades of learning of terrorism and terrorist activities. Our situation is much worse today because of the Oslo Accords than before the Oslo Accords. Before the Oslo Accords, it was just rocks. Today's everything. Today it's rockets all over the country. And all why? And again, this is one part of the puzzle. And yes, I'm simplifying it, but it is a very important piece of the puzzle. Because the state of Israel that Yitzhak Rabin understood was not able to fight and defeat our enemies because of being stopped by the Supreme Court. Now, I want to give a few more examples. Again, I'm trying to give the history here. Why the necessity for the judicial reform, not only that the right need, that understands that's needed, but even the left. And again, it's not just Chaim Ramon who's saying it today, that he's in the article, he's supporting the judicial reform. The former leader of the Labor Party is basically, in his interview, 100% supporting the judicial reform today. Again, former leader of the Labor Party. But not only that, I can give you the quotes of Yair Lapid supporting judicial reform, saying that the Supreme Court justices have too much power, that the activism of the Supreme Court instituted by Aaron Barak, by former Chief Justice Aaron Barak, went too far. That's Yair Lapid, today's leader, who's not even sitting down at the table to negotiate what type of reforms to do or not to do. That's Yair Lapid saying it himself, and I can give you the videos with his quotes. Just ask me for them, I'll send them to you. Another one in the opposition, Gideon Saar, who used to be Likud, he was a big supporter of judicial reform. Today, in the opposition, he's saying that it shouldn't be done, or it shouldn't be done the way it's being done, whatever. But even more than that, there was a committee hearing. I don't know how into detail you all are about Israeli politics or what's going on with judicial reforms, and I don't want to get into too much detail, but there is a committee meeting. Anyone familiar with politics, all right? A politician proposes a bill, all right? After it's voted upon, it then goes to committee. And then in the committee, it's talked about, discussed, argued, and that's where compromises take place, right? And then it goes back for a second voting and a third voting. This is Israeli politics. And then once it passes the third vote, then it becomes law. So just last week, Simcha Rotman, who is the Chaver Knesset, who is running the Law and Constitution Committee dealing with these judicial reform laws, he had a conversation with someone in Avigdor Lieberman's Yisrael Beiteinu party. I forgot his name, Forer. I always forget how to pronounce his name. And he said to Forer, he goes, in 2016, you proposed judicial reform law, meaning you as a representative of the Yisrael Beiteinu party, who today are saying you're against judicial reform, you proposed even stronger than my bill. I'll make a deal with you. I will put my bill aside, this is Simcha Rothman, and let's put up a vote, your bill that you wrote on behalf of the Israel Beiteinu party in 2016. Is any of this information being given to you on a daily basis?
No.
Nothing. What we're seeing in the media is a show. It's a clown show that is sad because it's dangerous. It has nothing to do with reality. It has nothing to do with the actual details of the judicial reform. I'm not going to go into the details here, but I'm the first to tell you that nobody on the right or in the government has any problem of sitting in that committee and actually talking it out and coming to compromises with representatives from the center left. But the problem is, and Chaim Ramon said it himself in this interview, the center left are not sitting down to make and to talk. They've turned this into a clown show, literally igniting the country on fire by actually saying it's going to lead to a civil war for no reason. You're talking about laws that were proposed by those same people who are today in the opposition, maybe a little different, maybe stronger, maybe a little weaker. And instead of coming to the table for something that everyone recognizes, at least publicly, is necessary, and let's just come to a compromise. And I'll tell you right now, I know how politics works. And even if you look at all the details of the different law proposals of this reform, the right wing, Simcha Rotman, Justice Minister Yariv Levin, they are fine in making compromises. They put red herrings in there in order to save for the negotiations. That's what politicians do. That's what politicians do when you go to the negotiating table. You try to come with a strong hand, knowing that you're going to make it a little weaker. But they're not even coming to the table. Instead, they're lighting the country on fire, screaming out civil war, civil war, civil war. Right? Which is beyond irresponsible. Beyond irresponsible. It's even traitorous because some of these leaders are calling not to serve in the Israeli army, not to go to reserve duty, pull your money out of the country, pull your companies out of the country, leave the country. So then you have to understand, so what's this really about? All right? And again, it's not about the details of the judicial reform. They could sit down and work it all out because they all understand the problems with the Supreme Court. And I'll go into some of those problems in a second. But so what's this about? What is really going on? Because it's not about the judicial reform.
So what is it?
Okay. So first let's touch upon some of the other examples of why this judicial reform is necessary. And then we'll go into what is this? What's this really about? Okay? Everyone familiar with the issue of Haredim not serving in the army in Israel? Okay. Who is familiar with Chok Tal? Chok Tal? Chok Tal is a law that was proposed in order to come up with a legal structure so that some Haredim would serve in the army, some Haredim wouldn't serve in the army, right? Because the whole situation right now is off the books, basically. Right? And everyone's in trouble because of it. The army's in trouble because of it. Haredim are in trouble because of it. It's all off the books. There's no law dealing with how Haredim should be treated in terms of going to the army or not going to the army. So Chok Tal was proposed in order to legalize and come up with a solution. Not all Haredim would go to the army. Some would. There'd be certain numbers, depending on how old you are or if you have kids or whatever. Right? A whole law. A whole law. Guess who struck the law down? Supreme Court. Not once, not twice, I think three times, if I'm not mistaken. That every time it was thrown back to the Knesset, and then the Knesset said, all right, we'll make these changes because you're saying you're not going to let us pass it without it. And then the Supreme Court again knocks it down. Again changes, again. So till this day, we don't have, this is over 10 years, if I'm not mistaken, but again, check me for those details, that there is no law for the Haredim and the army because of the Supreme Court. Right? Let me give you another one. Do you know that the Israeli law, which makes sense, is that someone who supports terror or supports the destruction of the Jewish state of Israel is forbidden from serving in Israel's parliament? Sounds pretty logical to me, wouldn't you say?
Cool.
Right? That's a law in the Israeli books. Guess who ignores that law? The Supreme Court. No. Every time there's an election and certain and certain Chavrei Knesset are forbidden to run for election because they have publicly supported terror or publicly supported the destruction of the state of Israel, and hence, according to Israeli law, should be forbidden from serving in Israel's parliament, the Supreme Court overrules and allows them to run. All right? And let me tell you a secret. Do you know who is the most impacted by this illegal, and I call it illegal, action by the Supreme Court and the legal authority? Who's most affected? The Arab Israelis who are loyal citizens and want and need representation in the Knesset. Because instead of them having representation looking out for their interests, they have representation supporting actions to destroy the state of Israel, whether within Israel's own Knesset or on the world stage. They go around the world bashing Israel as Israeli Knesset members and then asking for support of foreign countries to basically weaken Israel to ultimately destroy it. So, obviously, all of Israel loses out by having that illegal representation sitting in our own Knesset. But the biggest losers of that situation are loyal Arab Israelis who are left with no representation to look after their interests. All right, number two. Another one. The army. All right, I'm a soldier. I still serve in reserve duty, thank God. My kids are, my first son is about to finish his service. My second son is about to start his service in 2 weeks to go to Tzanchanim, to paratroopers. When we go to the army and we have to deal with terror, and I take my hat off to every single IDF soldier, each and every one of us, every one of them are holy. But we have to go through a 30-minute speech on rules of engagement before we go out to action. Do you know what 30 minutes of trying to understand what rules of engagement means? It means that when you're in a situation with a potential terrorist, you have to be going through your head all the different scenarios if you're allowed to do anything, and if so, what are you allowed to do? And as a soldier who has to act within seconds, to then have to be worried about, am I going to be court-martialed if I do something that doesn't go according to the rules of engagement, as opposed to, I have to protect someone, I'm going to do the best I can to do that, to ensure that everyone who needs protection is protection. And then, you know what? Sometimes mistakes are made, but when you're a soldier and you have split seconds to make a decision to protect whether fellow soldiers or innocent civilians, instead to be afraid of potentially being court-martialed, that's horrible. And that's dangerous. And all Israelis are in danger because of that situation. And that's something also because of the legal establishment and the legalization of how the army is able to act as well. Part of going back to what Rabin said back in the early 1990s, bli bagatz u bli batzelem, right? Because they stopped the army from really being able to do things. These are only some of the things. Another thing, I'm a proud Jewish settler in Judea and Samaria, living in Efrat. Arabs can build however they want, wherever they want. The army doesn't do anything. Jews, we're not allowed to build. And if we are, even if it's just we put up a roof on our merpeset, on our porch, and we didn't get the right permissions, they'll come within the days to knock it down. But Arabs are building tens of thousands of illegal homes. Do you know why? Why this is allowed in the state of Israel and Judea and Samaria? Because our Supreme Court treats all land in Judea and Samaria as official occupation, as if it belongs to the Arabs. That's the Israeli Supreme Court. So all government actions have to basically fall in line according to that legal understanding of Judea and Samaria, of our own land. That is why it is so hard to stop the illegal buildings. And that's why the army hardly stops illegal buildings, but yet goes out after Jews if something's built, but maybe illegally or whatever. Right? These are all issues. These are specifically having to do with the decisions of the Supreme Court. And then I didn't even touch upon the fact that Len mentioned before, the Supreme Court justice is basically, it's a friend bring friend system. There's the meaning on the selection committee, which is one of the things that they want to change. It's a selection committee of 9, 3 Supreme Court justices, 3 politicians, I think, 2 from the coalition, 1 from the opposition, and then 3 lawyers. Now, here's the thing. The 3 Supreme Court justices always vote together as a block, because they always want to make sure they're going to get people they want, right? You have to have a majority of 7 in order to approve a new judge. You can't get that majority without the 3 Supreme Court judges, right? Now, let's jump to the 3 lawyers. Guess who the lawyers have to appease in order to ensure that they get good jobs moving forward? The Supreme Court judges, all right? So it's a rigged system. It's a rigged system. And that's not going into the nepotism. Just this week, Aaron Barak was interviewed, and the interviewer from Channel 12 or Channel 13, he was asking Aaron Barak, he goes, "How was it that you allowed your children to be apprentices under your friends, who's the Supreme Court judge, and you had his children as your apprentices?" The nepotism screams to the high heavens in the Supreme Court, right, and in the legal system. And Aaron Barak goes, "You know, you're right. It's a good thing they stopped it." Right? Just look for the video. Right? But there is a problem. There is a problem there that has to be changed. And that's why when Bibi Netanyahu or Bezalel Smotrich or anyone else says that these judicial reforms are necessary to strengthen Israeli democracy, that's the truth. Because the level of trust from the Israeli public in the justice system is every year goes down and down and down and down. And you can't have a functioning country or democracy if there is little to no trust in the justice system. That's the reality that is not being talked about. All right, and I think if I'm not mistaken, Chaim Ramon mentioned that exact same point himself. So what is going on here? Using American political jargon, you have 3 branches of government: legislative, executive, and judicial. You have to have checks and balances between the 3. Then you have a strong functioning democracy, right? They're all on equal playing level, each have checks and balances, right? That's democracy. What do we have in Israel? We have the legislative and the executive, and then we have the judicial that has all the power. They've, over the years since Aaron Barak's judicial revolution, and that's the other point I forgot to mention, the judicial runs everything. They approve political appointments. They can, if Bibi has a political appointment the legal system doesn't like, they say no, not allowed to be appointed. If there's a law, there's 2 different levels of stopping laws in Israel. The first level is if it gets passed, and the Supreme Court then knocks it down. But there's a much more silent and dangerous level. And that's, it doesn't even get to the Knesset floor, because the attorney generals of the different ministries basically tell the politicians, "I'm not going to defend that at the Supreme Court." So politicians and ministers give up on even trying to pass laws, because they know they don't have the backing of the attorney generals, the legal representative to defend the government in the Supreme Court. They basically say, "No, we're not going to defend it. We can't defend it." Instead of being an attorney general saying, "Listen, there are issues here. This is what you got to do in order to pass this law." Doesn't happen in Israel. Attorney general says, "No, I'm not going to defend it." To the extent that just last year, there was one minister, I'm trying to remember what his name was, and whatever decision it had to do with him, the attorney general said he was not going to defend him, and the minister himself went to defend himself, and the attorney general said, "You're not allowed to do that." So the minister said, "Wait a second. You're supposed to defend me and my ministry. You're saying I can't, you're not going to defend me, and now you're saying it's forbidden for me to defend myself too?" It's, the judicial is on top of the executive and the legislative. And this judicial reform is about rebalancing the 3 branches of government so that we have a strong functioning democracy.
We have no separation of the three branches of government don't exist in Israel. The legislative and the executive is one and the same. There's no member of parliament that is not a member of the Knesset.
That actually just changed.
It's one and the same. There's no separation between executive and legislative in Israel.
Yes and no. Yes and no. There still is a difference. There still, because even though you're referring to the personalities, because some Chavrei Knesset can also be ministers, and hence they're also in the legislative and the executive. No, not anymore. Now with the Norwegian law, most of all the ministers are not in the Knesset. I don't know if all of them, but mostly all of them. But in any case, procedurally, it's still two separate processes. In any case, so that was, let me finish up and then we'll get to the questions, okay? Forgive me. All right, so then now we go back to the question. Okay, so what's this about? What's this about? Why the horrible protests? And why the screaming of civil war? And the threats of leaving the country, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All right, and again, this is my analysis based on everything I told you now and much, much more. And if you want to understand that much, much more, well, I talk about all these issues every day on my Pulse of Israel program. So just sign up and you can be better informed from information that's not gotten out there. What we're experiencing in Israel is a culture war. It's not about the judicial reform. It's a culture war. While me, and I'm sure every other person here in this room, is very proud that we have the Jewish state of Israel, and we should be proud, and it's an unbelievable miracle. Every single day is a miracle. We're only there because HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to be there. Right? So I teach my kids, guys, you're going to be soldiers, you're going to be the best soldiers in the world. You try your best, you give it your all, but guess what? No matter what, when a push comes to shove, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is in charge, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saving the Jewish people. And it's not just because we have an army, it's because we have Hashem. All right? We're his partners. We have to do our part, he does his part. But without his part, we wouldn't be there. If we just had the army, we didn't have Emunah and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we wouldn't be there. Okay? So we are all believers in a proud Jewish state of Israel. There is a small minority in Israel that is interested in Israel being Israel, but without the Jewish state. That's the culture war. Right? That's why today you have some of these protesters going around saying, and this was just published today, they're going around to different cities to, I don't know who they're giving these pieces of paper to, and they're saying, if you pass this judicial reform, we're no longer going to respect, we're going to start having chametz parties on Pesach outside your homes publicly. We're going to stop doing Brit Milah. Okay? To that level. I mean, that's what this is about. It's not about judicial reform. It's about a certain public in Israel, which is a minority, a tiny minority. And that's, again, don't trust me for anything, but don't trust the headlines either. It's not all of Israel. It's not half of Israel. It's not even as many people who voted for Meretz who are truly being militant about this. Most of the Israeli public who have issues with this judicial reform are willing to have compromises. They're not the ones screaming civil war. But the headlines that you're given on a daily basis, that we're given in Israel on a daily basis, is that there's going to be civil war. The only one screaming that and actually backing and handing out these pieces of paper saying we're going to basically kill the Jewish character of the Jewish state of Israel if you get rid of our democracy, which is a big lie, they're a tiny minority. And that's also, if you understand it, again, Made Aliyah 1990, I actively protested against the Oslo Accords, saying it would bring more war and terror and would push peace further away. I actively protested against Sharon's Gaza disengagement in 2005 because I said it would bring terror on Israel and more rockets on Israel and would push peace further away. We were decimated in Israel. Also on a, I'm not even gonna go there, this is a different topic, but I did videos on this, the undemocratic way those plans were pushed forward on the Israeli public. Totally undemocratic. Supreme Court did not intervene. Right, that's another thing. Mostly everything is ideological. I mean, I'll just get this one example. You're seeing pictures every day of people, protesters in on the Ayalon Highway, the main highway in Tel Aviv, right? And unfortunately, I mean, police are there, but they're hardly doing anything. And it took a few days before they actually started like trying to get rid of them in order to open up a highway for cars to drive on. Guess what? When I was out in the streets protesting against disengagement or against Oslo, we were run off the streets in seconds. Not only that, in the Gaza disengagement, the legal establishment, the Attorney General, officially said, according to law, anyone caught protesting against the disengagement would be treated as a traitor. And they basically took teenagers and threw them into jail. And again, I wrote an article about this back in OU Jewish Action 2006. They'd be treated as traitors and they need re-education. That was the Attorney General's office. Today, they're allowed to run amok and protest in the streets. The police are not. I mean, if those were ultra-Orthodox Haredim out there, they'd be getting rid of them in seconds. If those were settlers out there protesting, they'd be getting rid of them in seconds. But somehow, there's a different treatment by the legal establishment depending upon who's protesting, all right? So what's this about? This is a culture war. And unfortunately, even though it's a tiny minority, that have a very strong place in the legal establishment, in the media, in the university system. So hence, the picture we're all given is that the country's burning. But the country's not burning. And as I said before, most of the Jewish public in Israel, regardless if they're 100% supportive or they have issues with the judicial reform, they're not going out to fight a civil war. To fight a civil war, you need two sides. There's no two sides here. There's one side, there's a majority of the Jewish people, and then there's a tiny minority who are a side show. They're not a side. But because they are powerful and influential, and because they are taking advantage of a political situation, because there is a greater political context to this whole situation, which is that the right wing, for the first time ever, is totally running the Israeli government. Never before in Israeli history, for 75 years, has there been a full coalition just of proud Jewish nationalist parties. Never. Every single other coalition that had the Likud either included Labor or included some other centrist left party. This is the first time ever in Israel's 75-year history that it is a full, proudly Jewish nationalist party, and all the center left Arab parties are not in the governing coalition. That's the greater context. The anger is great. And people are playing upon that anger and playing upon that fear, thinking, oh my God, the religious extremists came to power, they're now going to turn us into Iran. It's absurd. It's sad. It's blatant lies that are extremely harmful, and you don't know what could come out of this. You don't know who can go and do extreme things because of it. But even if extreme things happen, it's by individuals, by a tiny sideshow minority, which is blown up to be much bigger than it is. And with this all, and this is the last point, and then I'll take questions and all questions and challenge me, please. With it all, I wouldn't want to live in any other country in the world. We're home, guys. We're home. HaKadosh Baruch Hu in every generation gives us challenges. Challenges from within and challenges from without. But to focus on any one of these issues, and every day we have a different issue. Every day we have a different challenge. And to think that because of that, things are bad, or the state of Israel is bad, or I don't want my kids living there, or I don't want to live there. No, no, no. Don't even go there. We are a living miracle each and every day. And if you just put the news aside, the amount of chesed, the amount of good being done by all different strata of the Israeli population within Israel and for all of humanity around the world has never been greater. We've never been making a bigger impact on the world than we are today, thanks to our Jewish state of Israel, which is imperfect and a work in progress. And our job as Jews is to be part of that work in progress. And the best way to do that is by being there. So that's the optimism. Yes, yes, Rabbi.
Maybe I missed it. Just let me ask a few questions. How many justices are there? How long do they serve? And how are they voted to office?
Okay, there are 15 justices. 15 justices. They serve for life. Once you're appointed, you're for life. And again, that's a very important point. I'm glad you asked me, because one of the things that people say is that, oh my God, because the judicial reform has the politicians or the coalition choosing this, having more power in the choosing of the Supreme Court justices on the committee, on the new committee that will be made, then that's politicizing the Supreme Court. But no, because they are independent. Once you are voted in, they're not dependent on the politicians anymore. They are independent forever until they retire. And then the last question, the last was, how are they voted? So again, there's a committee of nine.
A regular election year?
No. Depending when a Supreme Court justice retires, then a new one replaces them.
And then there's an election.
No election. Then there's a closed door. Then there's a closed door committee of nine, including three Supreme Court justices, three politicians, and three lawyers who sit down in a closed room and make deals. And another part of this judicial reform is to copy the more public hearing that is done here in the US politics, that any potential Supreme Court justice would then be questioned in a committee publicly. Everyone would know about the questions and the issues, and then a vote would be taken. So a much more transparent system.
You have nine people. They select somebody as the justice. Is that what you said?
Basically, yeah.
And then that person is in.
Yeah, if seven out of the nine agreed, it's about making deals. Everyone comes with lists, and then.
I know that's going to happen, but I just want to know how they do it.
Exactly like that. Right.
So that's where the court, that's where the press goes.
Right, but the thing that has to be changed is neutering the veto that three Supreme Court justices have over a committee of nine. Yes?
Yeah, I don't know if you saw the article today, the Times of Israel, that David Friedman spoke at the conference of major Jewish organizations.
Yeah. So look at the details. Details are important. David Friedman did not come out against judicial reform. David Friedman voiced concern about one aspect of one specific, the override clause. Yeah. Okay, so now let's talk about the override clause since you brought it up, and then I'll get to the other questions. The override clause basically means that if the Supreme Court makes a decision and then the government, the Knesset, the parliament, wants to override it, then if they have 61 votes, they can override the Supreme Court annulling the bill. Now, here's another piece of information that no one's told about. Whether or not that remains part of the judicial reform or not, and I will be the first to tell you, I'm almost positive that's a red herring. I'm almost positive that's a red herring for the negotiation process. But regardless, what no one is telling you, and what Chaim Ramon says in his interview, Aaron Barak himself supports the override clause. How do we know he supports the override clause? Because it already exists on one of the basic laws, Chokei Yesod. One of the clauses of the Chokei Yesod has an override clause that in the past Aaron Barak has supported. Those were his bills that he wanted passed. So again, context is key. It's something that already exists as a potential mechanism for laws between the Knesset and the Supreme Court. But that was important because that's not given across in the article. That's only that aspect that he voiced concern about. Yes. He asked, getting straight down to it, how do you see this planning out? If I was a Navi, I wouldn't be here. I'll walk you through like the most I can. This government will fall if it does not pass the judicial reform. Right? Let me explain to you why. This government cannot do anything, cannot pass any laws it needs to do, unless it first passes the judicial reform. Because like I said before, even though, and a friend of mine wrote a book a number of years ago, and he titled it, "We Continue to Vote Right, Yet We Continue to Get Left." Because if, as I explained earlier, every time we vote in a right-wing government, the legal system, the Supreme Court, stops all policies that the right-wing parties promised to implement during their campaigns. So there was a lot of anger within the Israeli public against our right-wing parties because they're never able to, they never implement what we want. But it's not their fault, it's the judicial system's fault. So if that's why it's not, they're gonna continue, right? They have to continue because they're not gonna be able to do anything in Israel. I mean, for instance, right now what's happening, there's a lot of anger because just over the past week, a number of locations in Yudan Shamron were removed by the army, and people are angry at Smotrich. Wait a second, you got in there in order to stop that. They should be destroying the Arab homes, not the Jewish homes. And you didn't stop it. Because again, not every Israeli is sophisticated about how things work either, and it's the judicial system that implements that. Police also, again, they're angry. People are angry at Ben-Gvir. Ben-Gvir, if that was us out there protesting, we would have been taken off the streets in a second. And yet all of the protesters today, they're out there getting away with all they're doing. And again, it's not Ben-Gvir. It's because the judicial system is basically having different policies depending on who's... they can't stop. They have to go forward. Even though they're going to go forward, let's even say that they pass it with a third reading, guess where it's going to get stopped? Supreme Court. So, in the end, I can't tell you how it's going to play out, but potentially that's why you are going to see in the news, I don't know if they're writing about it yet, but they will write about it, about a potential constitutional crisis for Israel. Because you're going to see that Israel, this government's going to try to pass this in order to be able to properly rule, and then the Supreme Court's going to rule it out, and the clash of the titans. What would come after that point? Don't know, but that's why, and I have to give kudos to Yitzhak Herzog, the president, that he is trying. He is trying to bring about a negotiated a negotiation between the two sides. The problem is the political leaders of the left, and in this case it's Yair Lapid, who himself, as I explained to you before, is extremely hypocritical in taking the stance he's taken, because he himself has supported the overpowerment of the Supreme Court and the need to have reform. He's climbed up a tree so high that any politician right now who sits down on the left, the center left, who sits down to talk and compromise is risking their political future with their base. Because you guys are being lied to every day in the media. Israelis are being lied to every day in the media. Again, we're being told in the media that democracy is going to be destroyed. They're not telling people what the details of the bills are. They're not telling that these own leaders supported it. They're telling them democracy is going to be destroyed. So everyone's scared. Everyone, those that are their activists, are scared. So for them to think that, oh my God, now you're going to sit down and negotiate? Well, that's it. I'm wiping you off my map. I'm not going to vote for you anymore. So it's a very tense situation. And Kadosh Baruch is going to take care of it. Do I know it's going to? Okay, that's the best I can do. Yes.
Well, first of all, thank you for the calls from Israel. I get it every day.
Thank you.
I just came back from Israel, and I wish the situation was like you're describing it. It is scary. My whole mishpacha is in Israel. I'm from Israel. It got to a point where I cannot talk to my own nephew. It's like, let's not discuss anything. Tel Aviv was totally locked down. My question is, Bibi, the right wing, was in the government for 10 years. Why not? This is what my family is asking me when I defend the whole thing. What's the big deal? We have it in the US, it's great. And they question, they say, tell us, why is Bibi doing it now? We know why, right?
Oh, you're asking me?
Yes.
Well, no, that's a total lie. It's a total lie. No, I'll explain to you. No, no, that's the lie they're given. 100%. That's the lie that they're given. 100%. Oh, no, no, yeah. That, again, it's just to expand. Basically, in Israel, they're telling the public that the reason Bibi is doing this now to make these judicial changes is in order to get him out of his court cases, out of his legal problems. So let me explain. Very important point. Okay, very important point. First of all, the justice minister is Yariv Levin. Yariv Levin, in his opening speech when he first became a Knesset member, I think it was 2009. In his opening speech in 2009 on the Knesset floor, and if it's not that year, look up the exact year, he spoke about the need for this judicial reform. This is years before Bibi had his legal problems. Simcha Rothman, he's the head of the Law and Constitution Committee, right? He wrote a book about judicial reform and started an organization pushing for the need for judicial reform, I think starting in 2013, before these cases against Bibi. It is a blatant lie that it's about Bibi. The constellation, it's easy to look at the situation and blame it on that, but it's nothing to do with Bibi. And the good news about Bibi, by the way, the good news about Bibi, and this is not given across in the media either, the court cases against him are falling apart at the seams. All of them. I don't know how familiar you guys are. There's Tik Elef, Tik Alpaim, Tik Shloshtalfim, Tik Arbat Alfim. They're all falling apart at the seams. Everyone who's following and knows what's going on sees that, unfortunately, once again, the legal establishment basically cooked up cases, pressured people to give false testify falsely against him. They're falling apart at the seams. Bibi doesn't need any changes to the judicial system to get acquitted. He's going to get acquitted in the end.
Do you know that Sarah Netanyahu was locked down?
Yes. 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 Did I answer the question, though? Did I answer? And this is the important thing. Unfortunately, we're all living in a time where it's not just this issue, it's any issue has been politicized, that it's been impossible to talk to even our close relatives, families, if we have different opinions. It is very scary times, and it's not just this issue, it's everything. Right, same thing. Right.
Can you help me clarify, this is part of what I'm missing here. Is there a catch-22 situation in the sense that Israel doesn't really have a constitution? You mentioned the Fokene Sof, and you mentioned balance of power, and Israel's government's not set up like the United States, meaning, as you mentioned. So how much of this judicial reform is informed by a desire to have a different kind of system that is more balanced, but at the same time, the definition of Israel's democracy without an actual constitution, and I know that there are reasons for why there isn't a constitution, which maybe you can touch upon, just puts this whole situation in a weird kind of catch 22 where nobody wins.
So I'll
just half a point related to what I actually had to ask before, is part of the reform, because I'm not familiar, something that would have, as you have in so many areas of Israeli life, mandatory retirement, is that something which, at a certain age?
Yeah, there is mandatory retirement. Yeah, I don't know, 65, I think? I don't know exactly what but yes, they have mandatory retirement. When they come to an age, and then they, yeah. So to answer your question, in terms of the catch-22, I'll explain to you how the catch-22 is even bigger than you think it is. Israel does not have a constitution, basically because you can never, and they tried, there were processes. I think it was Miki Eitan who led the Constitution Committee to try to write up a constitution. Because of the differences within the Jewish people, it's been impossible to come to a constitution, okay? Which is also at fault because it created a vacuum that then allowed Justice Minister Aaron Barak to push forward the Chukei Yesod back in the 1990s, which are called basic laws. And according to Aaron Barak, how's the catch-22? Officially, Israel doesn't have a constitution, but if you ask Aaron Barak and you look at any of his interviews, he says, and Israel has been acting accordingly, as if those basic laws are Israel's constitution. So Israel doesn't have a constitution, but it does have a constitution. Right? That's our situation. All right? How we move from here? Again, I don't even know to the level of detail of the reforms of how they're playing around with that. But one thing that also is connected to the override clause, and again, this is going into more details. Those of you interested in the details or not, I'm telling you anyway. Both sides. I'm not a supporter of the override clause, personally. But believe it or not, the override clause is something that those who are protesting today should be happy about. Because there were basically two different directions this reform could go. It can go saying the Supreme Court should have no power whatsoever to cancel any law. Meaning, obviously, if there are whatever constitutional laws, then it's clear and it's obvious. Or, so that would be one direction, they can't cancel anything, right? Or they can cancel, but they could potentially be canceled for canceling. Got it? So the judicial reform that is being worked on is giving power to the Supreme Court to potentially cancel, even while keeping potentially the power for the parliament to cancel the Supreme Court's cancellation. But there are plenty of people who say that none of that's bad, because we don't even want the Supreme Court to be able to do that. But again, this is getting much more into the details, and it's complex. Yes? One more question? Okay.
What is the aim of the ideology of the Supreme Court? Is it just culture change? Or is it just because they socialist, or they just don't like Trumkite?
Listen, it's a very good question. I think this is something that we experience as Jews in every single generation of our existence, where we have those amongst us who want to stay connected to their Jewish identity. What?
Louder?
I said, in every single generation, we experience this, where there are Jews who want to stay connected to their Jewish identity, and there are Jews who do not want to be connected to their Jewish identity. So in the past, or in Europe, or in America, or any country in the world, those who did not want to be associated with their Jewish identity, well, they assimilate. They assimilate, or they stay connected to their Jewish identity and try to change the way people think is a Jewish identity, which is basically happening today in America as well. Right? And that's happening in Israel. We have people who are born Jews, yet they want to be more Israeli than they want to be Jews. And that is not every Supreme Court justice, but that is the thinking, that is the gestalt of the legal establishment, not just Supreme Court justices. How can you have a Jewish Supreme Court in our eternal homeland who treats Judea and Samaria as occupied lands? That's our Supreme Court. It's not the international community. Right? That's our Supreme Court. So that's where it goes down to. In any case, once again, I want to say thank you for all of you for coming out tonight. Those of you who appreciate my voice and the information I give, which is counter to what we're usually given on a daily basis, you're more than welcome, one, to sign up to the Pulse of Israel. And anyone, I'm always looking for supporters, because many people out there prefer this information not get out there. So anyone who this resonates with, and I like to call myself putting out the politically incorrect truth, if that resonates with anyone and you want to be a supporter, just let me know, be in contact with me, and that would be greatly appreciated as well. Thank you. I'm Israel Chai.
Pulse of Israel, frontline videos from the Holy Land. Support our work by donating today.